Welcome to the Catbird Speaks podcast for BP Southside, the baseball prospectus site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes or our Blog Talk Radio page by searching for the Catbird Speaks. I'm Colin Wichurch, joining you a mere hours after the White Sox and Cubs culminated a blockbuster trade that sent Jose Quintana to the Cubs for four prospects, most notably global top 10 prospect Eloy Jimenez, along with probably top 100 pitching prospect Dylan Cease and two other lower-level prospects. So we're here to react and hot take it up. So I'm joined, as always, by Nicky Beeps, Nick Schaefer. What's up, Nick?
Hey, Colin. How you doing?
Good. So, like I said, this is we're still kind of catching our breath from, you know, the first big trade ship of the season. You know, we kind of thought Quintana would be going at some point. If you would have asked me yesterday if I thought Quintana was going to get traded by July 31st, I would have said probably no, because I didn't think that they were going to get the offer that it took to move him. But here we are. What do you think?
Wow. Yeah, it's hard to answer that just because there's so many different things I want to say. I guess responding to your last point about when I thought he was going to move. I always thought that his slow start was getting overblown just by the general public. I mean, I'm gauging based on what I see on Twitter, so who knows whether that's a representative sample or not of the fan base or just baseball conversation in general. Obviously, he didn't get off to a great start. Some of it seemed unlucky. Like I felt like the home runs he was giving up happened to be they weren't always on the worst pitches, and they always seemed to come with runners on base, which made it look worse. His peripherals were certainly better than his ERA, even when he was going badly. And then he's obviously James Fegan, editor emeritus, wrote about how he thought he'd fixed an issue with how he wasn't finishing on his curveball, and that allowed him to bury it low when he wanted to and get better command on it. You know, his typical command that we've seen for the last 3-4 years, really. And then for his last 6 or 7 starts, he basically looked like the guy we've come to know and love on the White Sox. And, you know, for all that the public is saying, oh no, his trade value is going to be lowered. You know, there wasn't any specific red flag that made me really worry that his talent had changed. And, you know, if I think it was going to take more than a couple of bad starts or a bad April or whatever for major league front offices to really change their evaluation on this guy. I feel like if a team didn't want to meet the White Sox price, it was because of doubts they had about Quintana or reasons why they wouldn't have wanted to meet that price anyway before the season started, having to do with the fact that he is kind of a two-pitch pitcher and he doesn't have premium velocity. He's a pitchability guy. He's a command guy. And, you know, he has an unusual background, and some teams aren't going to value that as much as others. But I really do I do feel strongly that he was the best pitcher available in terms of both immediate quality, in terms of durability, floor, like in terms of safety of investment, and in terms of years of control and the price that he was at. I thought that he was a really, really valuable asset, and I think that the trade reflects that. Before I list off the other like 3,000 things I think about this, what about you? What are your reactions?
Yeah, I guess my thought, Connor McKnight asked me on White Sox Weekly on Saturday if I thought Quintana was going to go, and I said if I were a betting man, I would say no. And the reason I would say no didn't have as much to do with Quintana's slow start as it did the market and the White Sox supposed asking price. We now know, based on the return, how high that asking price was, and it was those reports were legitimate. And I just kind of thought the way the market was looking and the way the playoffs were shaking out, particularly in the National League, which is where he ended up going, where, you know, most of the playoff spot, you know, there's such a clear line between the contenders and non-contenders in the National League that I didn't think that there was going to be a really hard bidding war, especially when you look at that there are some other pitchers who probably weren't going to cost as much available. If you look at like a Sonny Gray, Chris Archer will probably command quite a bit as well. But looking at those two and whether teams are willing to give up, you know, global top 10 talent for Quintana or maybe something a little less for one of those guys, or maybe even a lesser pitcher somewhere else. That was kind of where my thinking was, where it just didn't seem like the market was going to have that asking price and the need, or the I don't want to say panic, because it's not like it was a panic move by the Cubs, but just that teams weren't going to need it enough to give up that kind of talent.
Yeah, it's a weird, you know, the AL and NL have both. We've talked about this a little bit before, but it's still the case where, you know, the Nationals and Astros and I guess kind of the Dodgers have already sort of clinched their divisions at this stage, and you know, other teams that are in the running aren't necessarily, you know, Cleveland doesn't need Quintana. You know, he's not their issue. You know, their rotation's not really their issue. You know, you've got, I mean, everybody could use Quintana. Don't get me wrong. No team has five starters that are better than Quintana, and every team can afford him financially. So let's like, I mean, I'm not, you know, let's not miss that point. But, yeah, you look at like teams that you thought might've been interesting, like the Cardinals, they aren't really close enough now to like justify being in the bidding war.
Same with Pittsburgh.
Yeah, you know, teams that would especially put a premium on his cost effectiveness more so than, you know, this is something that Jared Seidler of our prospect team in BP Mets was saying in reaction to this trade on Twitter. You know, why are the Cubs prioritizing cost effectiveness here if that's his main selling point? You know, like I said, I feel pretty strongly about, you know, even if you compare him to, say, you know, Gray, like you said, is another option out there. Quintana is better than he is. I think he has one more year of control. If not, it's the same amount. And he's been more durable than Gray. You also have Archer, like you said, who may not even be available because the Rays are kind of still in it here.
Yeah.
And, you know, even a guy like DeGrom, who I think maybe on an inning per inning basis you could argue is better. DeGrom's never has thrown more than 150 innings once in his career. I mean, if you want to pay what it would cost to get a DeGrom, you're going to be, you know, crossing your fingers that he's going to be healthy come playoff time, which is why you would probably make a move like that. And I love DeGrom. I think he's amazing. Cueto is probably, you know, you could argue is better than Quintana, but he's got an opt-out after this year.
Yeah.
So, you know, none of these guys check all of the boxes that Quintana does. I mean, maybe if you're the Dodgers and you already have, you know, you've got Kershaw, you've got Alex Wood, and you've got Rich Hill, who are all pitching like front end starters. Maybe, you know, you could maybe argue that they'd be more interested in a Quintana because, frankly, those guys, the problem with Wood and Hill is that they have trouble staying healthy. And when you hit October, you want all your guys. But maybe by that same argument, you say, you know what, if I'm the Dodgers, I want DeGrom because if I stack enough of these guys who are just unhittable when they're on the mound, I'm going to have a couple of them available come playoff time and I can afford it. So I could see that going either way. But yeah, to stop the rambling, I mean, obviously the fact that the Brewers have gotten off to the start that they have, they look like they're arriving a little early as a young team with a ton of talent in the organization. That was a huge benefit to the White Sox to counteract teams like the Mets and Giants or whatever crashing out immediately, and Seattle falling so far behind Houston and so on. Even though Seattle doesn't have the farm for this. So, the Brewers getting ahead of the Cubs and kind of staying there, even if it was just those two teams, they both could use Quintana and you could theoretically just play them against each other and say, listen, if you don't get this, you know, if you were talking to the Cubs, I'd say, you know, if you don't get Quintana, the Brewers have offered us X, Y, and Z, maybe, and they're already ahead of you. I don't know if you want to take that chance, but
yeah, the actual deal now that it's happened is interesting because there have been so much back and forth since the winter, you know, about the White Sox asking price and, you know, did they turn down an offer that they should have taken in December? We don't know exactly what that offer is. If Houston was offering, you know, Kyle Tucker or X, Y, and Z, whatever, you know. But now that it's actually happened, I think it kind of more or less justifies what Rick Hahn was doing while he was waiting. I think that when you look at the return they got, and any other imaginary return you could have put together from supposed Quintana suitors, I believe, when the prospect team at Baseball Prospectus put together their midseason top 50, of course, Eloy Jimenez was number 8. So that now gives the White Sox another global top 10 talent, along with Moncada, who was number 1. And Dylan Cease was in the discussion for the top 50, as Craig Goldstein told us, and is a legitimate top 101 guy. I think if seeing what they got for him, A, justifies, I think, the waiting game they played, and B, you know, as an observer, as an analyst, as a fan, I'm pretty pleased with it. Are you?
Yeah, and like you said, it's sort of consistent with what we heard over the winter. They were asking for – the only actual deal that we know was proposed and rejected, at least that I've seen, other than rumors and references to certain pieces being asked for, was that the White Sox said, if you give us Kyle Tucker, Francis Martes, and Joe Musgrove, you can have Quintana, and the Astros said no. Kyle Tucker is 14 on the midseason top 50. He was, a blue chip guy, another blue chip corner outfielder. I'm sure you could find somebody who likes Tucker better than Eloy, but I think almost everything I've seen has Eloy as ahead of Tucker. And it's an interesting comparison because they profile to play sort of the same position, and Eloy has no doubt power, and Tucker, I guess, the power is arriving this year after a lot of people being sure it would come, but it not manifesting in games yet. Martes is already up in the majors. He's struggling a little bit. He was struggling in AAA, but I know people love his stuff, even if he's a little short for a right-handed pitcher. So, it kind of fits the shape of what they were asking for from Houston in a way, in that pairing of those front two. Even with Musgrove's really terrible season in the majors so far, I still think most people would value Musgrove over Fleet and Rose.
Sure.
Those guys, those are the third and fourth pieces of the deal. They're first baseman and second baseman, high A. I'm sure there are scouts in the White Sox organization who liked them enough such that they were selected as the third and fourth pieces. But, I think it's really Eloy, big drop off, Cease, ginormous drop off, and then those two guys. The return, the interesting thing about Cease too is, he's stop me if you've heard this before, he touches 100, he throws crazy hard, he might have a nice off speed pitch, and I think there are questions about whether he'll start.
Oh, no kidding. You mean a pitching prospect?
And he's an A-ball. Yeah, exactly. He's striking out 13 per 9 in A-ball.
He also has already had Tommy John surgery in his background.
Yeah, and he's, he's a little slight, I think. He's listed at 6'2", 190.
Totally fits the profile, though, of the type of pitcher the White Sox would target, though. I mean, yeah. Mid to high 90s fastball, they say he's got a changeup that projects to be plus if he can harness it. That is peak what the White Sox look for in pitchers that they acquire. And they're a pretty good organization to try to get him to his ceiling.
And the other thing, too, is that now, and we can get to this further in a minute, but the difference between having one or two of these guys and that being at the top of your top 10 as an organization is scary. Obviously, Dylan Cease is a better prospect than anything the White Sox would have had for a while, going back 5 years ago, something like that, where the top of the system was just like Carlos Sanchez.
Now
Yolmer. Yeah, Addison Reed going – and like Trace Thompson, where you're hoping median expectation bench player hoping for a second division starter. Trace, I guess, had a little more upside than that, as opposed to Cease – is a higher caliber than that. But Cease is like now one of, eight dudes who it's like, if it works in the White Sox system, where if it works out, he's like a mid to front row of the rotation starter. And if he doesn't work out, his reasonable low side is like phenomenal reliever. And if you stack enough of those dudes, you're giving yourself a really good chance that you're going to have some guys are going to stick in the rotation, and then the ones who don't and don't get hurt are probably going to make up an incredible bullpen.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's kind of cliche, but it's like, you know, the more lotto tickets you buy, the better your chance you have of winning. It's the thing that I think gets misconstrued about prospects sometimes is that they expect, like, you know, every single one of these guys isn't going to hit, you know, their potential. But if you have, from a pitching standpoint, you have Kopech, you have Giolito, you have Hanson, you have Lopez, you have Dunning, you have Cease. You could even throw in Spencer Adams to that mix, although he's a little younger than the rest of them. And it's like, you don't need all – how many names did I just list? Seven? Eight? You don't need all seven or eight of those guys to become part of your future rotation. You just need, like, three of them to hit, you know? and that's still pretty good. And the more chips you throw in there, the better chance you have of creating something worthwhile in 3-4 years.
And they do have this cool combination now of these high-octane guys, you know, the Kopech Lopez type, where, you know, if they've got they've got these really great arsenals, and then it's a sort of a durability and control question. And then you do have this sort of it's been a good year for their sort of rotation depth type guys where, you know, you mentioned Dunning. You mentioned Spencer Adams, as James wrote recently, striking more guys out, and he's, you know, never walks anybody. He keeps the ball on the ground. Super athletic guy. He was a second-round pick of the White Sox, I think, in 2014. And as I recall at the time, it was seen as sort of a steal where they got him.
I think he was an overslot. Baseball America really liked him.
I don't even know if he was overslot. I just think that Baseball America had him as a first-round talent, and he wound up going the second round to the White Sox. I'd have to go back and check his money on that.
Yeah. Also Jordan Guerrero.
Jordan Stevens, I think, as well. Yeah. These are all guys who have a solid shot to fill out the rotation. So like you said, even if, you know, let's say only Giolito and, I don't know, take your pick of these other dudes making the rotation behind Rodon, and then, you know, one of those other, Spencer Adams is your four, and then figure out the fifth starter slot, which shouldn't be too hard for the White Sox to do, and then you have like 30 of the best relievers in baseball or something, like piling up behind them.
I mean, just have them all out there throwing two innings at a time, and you win every game, right?
Yeah, there you go. problem solved. I think, I mean, we could continue.
Well, it is funny. It is funny you were talking about kind of where we've come as an organization as far as the farm system goes. Like, I mean, obviously what the White Sox did to get to this point where they're now building, you know, arguably the best farm system in baseball is sad and depressing in retrospect, because it means that they had to tear down, you know, a team that they were trying to contend, and we have to see a lot of our favorite players leave town, like Sale and Quintana. But it is funny to look back. I was just doing, you know, I was bored one day before the Futures game, and I was looking back at White Sox future game reps from years past, and it was like one guy a year, and it was Carlos Sanchez one year. And it was, I think, just as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, their only Futures game rep was Micah Johnson, who was really good. Diane Viciado was the Futures game rep one year. And now, you know, and obviously the Futures game is just the Futures game, and it doesn't have any actual representation of the farm. But now we got to see, you know, three White Sox in the Futures game last year. We've got a boatload of top 50 and top 100 guys. And, you know, you just got to hope now that it translates to the major league level at some point.
Yeah, you know, I went to the Futures game at Yankee Stadium in, I think, 2008. I want to say. Oh. And just off the top of my head, I remember seeing, guys who were prospects at the time who didn't pan out. But I definitely saw Carlos Carrasco in that game, and I definitely saw Andrew McCutchen rip a home run in that game.
It is really fun to look at those rosters and see like the guys who made it and the guys who you're like, who?
Yeah. Yeah, but even when going back to, gosh, when Carson Fulmer was drafted, at the time he was in the system, it was sort of the feeling was still as it had been for a long time with the White Sox, where it was like, man, if he's a reliever, like that's gonna really hurt because they don't have anything else. And now it's like, you know, if Fulmer's a reliever, and he probably is, that's fine. Like it doesn't matter. It's, yeah, they have so much They have so much depth. Even when they were getting the occasional major leaguer up from their system, it was like, you know, one or two guys that might make it. Addison Reed, for example, you know, you're saying, hey, our top prospect looks like he'll be a good reliever. And he is a good reliever. He's had a good career, and he looks like he'll continue to have a good career. But it's really hard to build a whole team out of that. It's also Matt, I quoted this on Twitter and sort of added to it right before we started recording. Matt Winkelman, who I really recommend following regardless of what team you root for, he's a prospects writer, really knows his stuff, primarily a Phillies guy, but he pointed out, you know, the White Sox have a really good farm system. The White Sox failed to be competitive with a rotation on Sale and Quintana on cheap deals. The reason, one of the main reasons they have such a good farm system right now is because teams that sell rarely have the assets that the White Sox did.
Yeah.
You know, most teams that have Eaton, Quintana, and Sale on the deals that they do aren't selling, because that should get you so close to competing that you should be able to stumble into it. And obviously the White Sox couldn't. I don't want to relitigate all that, but that is sort of, this is, if this feels unusual, it's because it is. This is really weird.
The rebuilds of recent years that everyone talks about obviously are the Cubs and the Astros. You know, those teams didn't even, when they decided to sell, didn't have a ton of in their prime talent. And you look at even more recently, you look at a team that's still struggling and whose rebuild just doesn't seem like it has a stop date yet is the Phillies. You know, mm-hmm. when they decided that they were going to sell, and obviously they got a World Series out of their course, so, you know, it was worth it in the end, at least in my opinion. I don't know. You know, Phillies fans than I do.
They won a World Series. They went back to another. They won 102 games another year. I mean, it was a really good sustained run. Like, those Phillies were really great for, what, like 5-6 years in a row?
Yeah, but by the time things got to the point where it's like, okay, we need to rebuild, they didn't have a lot of guys with a lot of value anymore all of a sudden. You know, Hamels was the outlier, obviously. They got a boatload of good prospects for Cole Hamels. But that was it, you know, and the White Sox, you know, decided to rebuild, and maybe they pulled the plug too early. Maybe, you know, we shouted from the mountaintops for years about how they failed to supplement their core with major league caliber talent in order to contend. And that is unfortunate. You know, we got to kind of move past that at that point. But now all of a sudden you had three in their prime all-star caliber players in Sale, Quintana, and Eaton, who they got. Someone just recently tweeted out, I can't find it now, but the list of all the players the White Sox acquired for Sale, Quintana, and Eaton. And it's like 12 players, you know, and it's
it'd be 11 guys, yeah.
Yeah, 11 guys, and, you know, if a bunch of those hits, then the window opens back up in a couple of years. I just, by the way, I just found, I was searching as we were talking at the 2008 Futures game rosters.
Oh, yeah.
From the game that you attended. There were two White Sox in that game. Can you name them?
Ooh. Was Vicieto one of them?
Vicieto was not one of them. One of these guys is still in the major leagues.
For some reason, the name that I have in my head that I know wasn't a White Sox and I can't get out of my head is like Sheron Martiz. I feel like he was in there.
I don't know I'm if like Sheron Martiz was in it, but oh yeah, there he is. He was with Washington.
I have no idea what. And like Henry Rodriguez, I remember seeing him pitch because I remember joking. We were lucky enough to sit in the back with my friend and I. We got to meet like Jason Stark and Keith Law and a bunch of other you were really nice to us. I mean, I was in college. I was a teenager, basically at the time.
Yeah.
I remember my friend joking with them about how like pickoffs to first base must be the new market inefficiency, because there were a couple dudes that got picked off by Oakland pitchers in a row. I couldn't tell you. I blacked out so much of those White Sox years. They're so depressing.
All right. So they were both on the U.S. team. Pitcher, current major leaguer, Clayton Richard.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I never would have gotten that.
And the other one, this cracks me up, is the current –
Parada?
current White Sox farm or scouting director.
Oh, is it Chris? Oh, scouting director?
Getz.
Yeah. I think he's like a minor league coordinator or something like that. Vice president of player development.
That's a fun roster, though. Jake Arrieta was in that game.
Oh, yeah.
Chris Davis. Chris with a C, Davis, when he was still in the Rangers organization. Matt LaPorta, famous bust.
Oh, my God. Yeah, also famous bust. I should have written this up for the top 50 bust that went up today. Angel Angel Villalona. I don't know if you remember him. The Giants signed him. He was supposed to be this mega bat prospect. They signed him as like a 16-year-old. I think out of the Dominican, but he then almost certainly murdered a guy and settled the case with the families of the victim for like hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I don't know what became of him after that, but he's not in the majors. So
yeah, famous bust.
Fernando Martinez made our bust list. He was there. I think Jesus Montero is that the name I'm seeing?
He was. World catchers were Jesus Montero and Wellington Castillo.
Yes, one of them's a catcher. Stolmy Pimentel, if you remember him. I think Randall Delgado is here.
The U.S. outfield is actually a really fun one, too, because it's Dexter Fowler, Andrew McCutchen, Denard Span, Nate Shearholtz, and Greg Golson, if you remember him.
I do remember
Greg Golson. Also, you were correct about Carlos Carrasco, and also another nice little prospect bust candidate is Philip Aumont. I don't know if I'm saying
Philippe Aumont.
Philippe Aumont.
He was one of the centerpieces traded for Cliff Lee, the first Cliff Lee deal, or maybe the first of like three or four.
The Philly to Seattle Cliff Lee deal, I believe, is
right. The one that when Cliff Lee had just came off an amazing year, or his second amazing year in a row, if I'm not mistaken, and helped the Phillies to the World Series, and then to appear in the World Series, if I'm not messing up my timeline. And then Ruben Amaro Jr. initially said, well, we traded him to reload the farm system. And then it turned out that all those prospects were terrible. And then he said, well, it's because we needed to save the money. But the amount of money on Cliff Lee's deal was the equivalent to the amount of money they spent on Ross Glode and Joe Blanton, I think, for that next season. So that was a tough sell. But yeah, this U.S. futures team had a lot of the guys on our top 50 bust list, or at least in the conversation for it. I mean, Jason Donald is on there. I think he was in one of those. Was he on one of the Cliff Lee trades too?
Who?
Jason Donald. He was traded from, I think.
Yeah, he went
Philly
to
Cleveland.
Yes.
Taylor Teagarden.
Also on the 2008 futures game roster.
Was Golson ever on the White Sox?
Not that I recall, but Aumont was an NRI like 2 years ago, wasn't he, with the White Sox? Yeah,
he retired.
Yeah.
Greg Golson.
I remember him as a Yankee for some reason.
He was on the Yankees, but his baseball reference photo has him with a White Sox hat.
No shit.
I called it. There we go. I knew it. I think he was just on a minor league deal. He never played in the majors. Yeah, he played for Charlotte for the whole season.
You know, we have a two-man podcast today, and I said to myself, we only have two people on the podcast. There's no way we're going to go off subject with some random tangents. And yet here we are. It's a Catbird Speaks tradition for us. You know, we're talking about Quintana, but let's talk about 2008 prospects too.
Yeah. You know, well, those are the safe prospects to talk about because we know how they turned out at this point.
But it's also good because we're doing some cross promotion with the main site because people need to hop onto baseballperspectives.com and look at the top 50 prospect busts of all time, which features write-ups by you, Nick, as well as Mark Primiano, our own Dr. 100, and our editor emeritus, James Fegan. Did Ryan do one, too? I don't remember.
I don't think so. Marks are really good. James's is really good, unsurprisingly. I submitted three. Two of them got picked. Okay. I actually, in retrospect, I wonder if the one that didn't get picked was my best. There were a lot of people. I mean, it's such a fun. You could do this infinitely. I mean, it's such a fascinating aspect of the sport. But I had Josh Vitters of Cubs bust fame sort of around the same time period. And I also had Brian Bullington, who was a number one overall pick by the Pirates.
Yes. I also read that.
Yeah. I also wrote up a quick little thing on Kirk Brown in case Patrick needed need a couple more to round out the 50 if people couldn't get around to what they had intended to write. Kurt Brown, as you recall, in the 1985 draft, I think the first – the first six picks of the draft were – so pick number one was, I think, B.J. Surhoff, who had a really good career. Number
like 30 years.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I'm blanking on number two. Number three was like a league average pitcher who pitched for like 15 years, like Bobby Witt, I think. Barry Larkin was in the top four. Gosh, I'm sad that I'm blanking on two because I know – I think he was
Hang on.
Really
I got you. I got you. B.J. Surhoff. Number two is Will Clark.
Will Clark, who was a really, really good player.
Yes, star-level player.
And number six was Barry Bonds. Number five was the White Sox, and they picked Kurt Brown, who had a minor league OPS around 600 for 5 years and retired. He was a high school catcher who never played in the majors, who was not Barry Bonds. So, you know, not to – wasn't trying to rag on Kurt Brown. I mean, it's not his fault that he looked really good in high school in the White Sox. thought it was better than Barry Bonds, but so it goes. And I'm sure there was some sort of signability thing with Bonds because Bonds was like a known star coming into college. So, you know, it's not as simple as saying they thought Kurt Brown was better, but, you know.
I should tell you, this is off topic, but there is some Twitter chatter currently of some rumors of the White Sox calling up Yoan Moncada. So we might be discussing breaking news right here.
Yes, I don't think
it's true. Daryl Van Schoen just tweeted that he was told the White Sox are not calling up Moncada tomorrow. But it was a screenshot that our own former best friend James Fegan tweeted, and a couple other people picked up on, where the active roster currently has Yoan Moncada listed. So I don't know. I just thought I would mention it so that we can. If it happens tomorrow, we on this podcast are ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and, you know, if Daryl Van Schoen says he's not, I'm going to go with Daryl Van Schoen over.
DVS would know.
Pretty much anything else. I mean, DVS is a consummate professional.
It's definitely a weird error, though, that they
Yeah, and on the heels of that trade, too, but I would – Gosh, when we spoke only just last week about the Moncada, when he comes up, if he comes up, that sort of thing. And so, you know, I think it's not like there's been a whole lot of baseball played since then. So if you're interested in that conversation, I definitely recommend go back and listen to that episode with Craig Goldstein. Don't need to rehash that here. But yeah, I saw that creep across my my news feed at a glance. So, yeah, Quintana. Can I just – I try to just be – you know, you try to be a dispassionate analyst, or at least I strive to do that as often as I can and just step back. And, you know, I am a White Sox fan. I hope they do well. But I also try to give good analysis separate and apart from that. But Quintana was – it kind of hurts almost more than Sale leaving did. And maybe this is a weird way that I approach sports or have approached sports fandom where, for example – growing up in the 90s as a Bulls fan, obviously I love Michael Jordan. I was really I was giddy that he was on the team I rooted for. But in a way, Jordan felt like he was sort of – like everyone was a Jordan fan. He transcended sort of team status. And, you know, as much as I was fiercely proud of Chris Sale, as you know, he's on the White Sox. He's what makes the White Sox special. And he's, you know, been one of the five best pitchers in the majors – you know, pretty much since he came into the league. And but in that same way, Sale felt sort of felt like cheating to say he was your favorite. Like he was sort of transcended team status. But Quintana felt, at least to me, maybe it's because he was the number two guy. I just felt very drawn to him. And he's just such a great story because he's just this really hard worker, came from nowhere, you know, minor league free agent who just kept getting better when nobody really thought that would happen. And he's just so fun to watch and to watch him, like, you know, when Josh Donaldson was so confused as to, he's like, how are we getting like annihilated by this dude who throws 92 and like one off speed pitch? Like Donaldson didn't get it. And it's just, that's what makes him so – one of the many things that makes him so much fun and so unique. And it was
you know, it's cool that the White Sox were able to get all that production out of a minor league free agent and turn him into a blue chip, one or two blue chip prospects. But, you know, it does suck that we're not going to get to watch him pitch every fifth day and not have it on the White Sox, as much as I'm happy that he doesn't have to sell his house and move his family. And he stays in Chicago and he's going to a team, you know, this massively increases his chances of pitching in the playoffs under the length of his current contract. I mean, the Cubs are just, you know, a good shot to make the playoffs this year and a very good shot to make it going forward for the next 2 to 3 years. So, you know, I'm happy for him in all that, all those regards, but I don't know. It hurts too. It's a bummer in that way.
Yeah, for sure. I wrote about, I tweeted this out earlier. I wrote about kind of the things you were mentioning last September, right after his last start of the season, just kind of like, you know, if this is the last time we see Quintana pitch for the White Sox, you know, he's worth appreciating. It is kind of crazy to look back. I remember the off season between the 2013 and 14 season, you know, the year that they made the Addison Reed trade and that they made the Adam Eaton trade. And everyone, you know, all the speculation going into that offseason was that, you know, the White Sox were going to trade one of their young lefty pitchers in hope for some offensive help. And all the reports were, you know, they're making Hector Santiago available, but Jose Quintana's untouchable. Jose Quintana's untouchable. And I thought that was so weird. I was like, you know, because it's easy to, I mean, obviously Quintana was far from an established pitcher at that point, but it kind of is a microcosm of how easy, it was easy at the time for us as fans to kind of not be able to see what the White Sox saw in him, you know, to make him untouchable that offseason. And, you know, if you're just casually watching and following baseball and following the White Sox, it was easy to miss, you know, his brilliance. And his brilliance was extrapolated by his journey, you know, by the fact that he came from where he came from, obscurity, kind of worked his way up, and he's always been the nicest guy ever, you know. I just remember reading some of those quotes when he was pitching for Colombia and when they almost upset the U.S. in the World Baseball Classic about, you know, wanting to almost reaching the top of the mountain or whatever. I'm not going to try to repeat it word for word because I'll misquote it, but it was just one of those things that made you see how much he cared. And, you know, I sound like I'm eulogizing him now like he died, but no, I totally echo everything you said. You know, it's easy to for Sale to be your favorite, but, you know, Quintana's so long been so underappreciated that it kind of made you like him more. It almost made it was like we were baseball hipsters, like, oh, you don't know how good Quintana is, you know, because you don't watch him every day like I do. I've been watching Quintana since he was on vinyl, you know. So it does suck. It's gonna suck not watching him pitch for the White Sox. You know, it's not that there was ever much of a chance for it, but I am glad that he's not on an American League Central team that I have to root vehemently against him every day, right? You know, watching the Cubs is easy. You know, they're not my favorite team, but I know there are some White Sox fans who will always hate the Cubs. I'm not one of them. So I will still root for him to succeed. And I hope that he gets a nice national stage on the playoffs where he can do one of his patented 7 innings, no runs, 10 strikeout games. And everyone says, who the hell is Jose Quintana? And where did he come from? How is he doing this?
Right. And, you know, I remember, you know, part of me is relieved in the sense that because he's a pitcher, even though Quintana's been crazy durable, there was this sort of fear that, you know, he'd have some sort of arm injury and they wouldn't be able to trade him. Mm-hmm. And from, you know, an org building standpoint, that would have been devastating. And it would have been absolutely insufferable to listen to everybody scream about how they shouldn't have traded him, how they should have traded him over the winter. What drove me nuts about those, by the way, just those people saying they should have traded him in the winter. What are they doing? What are they doing? That drove me insane because we didn't see, as far as I knew, we didn't see what any of those offers that they got over the winter were. We have no idea what the White Sox turned out. People are like, oh, their prices are too high. It's like, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know. If a team only, like, if the Phillies called you up and said, you can have Scott Kingery and that's it,
the White Sox should tell him to take a walk. Like, they shouldn't make that deal. That's a bad offer. It's so to say that people are just guessing, they don't know. It's enough, like, to say you paid too much for that car. It's like, well, the car works. So, like, do you know how much I paid for it? No. So you don't know what you're talking about. You have no idea. Like, so that bothers me. The other thing was that Quintana was under control for so long that you were going to have multiple opportunities. And here, you know, we can get into this in a second. They had an opportunity where somebody really needed him, for one thing. And if you're so afraid that if you hang on to him, his value will decline because he'll have less time at control left, or he'll get hurt, or he'll get worse. What you're saying is, I'm afraid we won't get enough for him in a trade. The solution to that is not to freak out and get less for him than you want in a trade, because you're just hitting fast forward to the thing you're afraid of. So I think, obviously, like you said at the beginning of this conversation, this sort of bears out the White Sox approach to dealing him. And, you know, depending on what they think of Cease and what they think of the other two throw-ins or not, you know, I'm sure the White Sox have their own eval on all those guys. But I think this is arguably a really great return for Quintana. You know, it's all going to depend on what happens with these guys, but you can only, you know, evaluate them as best you can and then go forward from there. I just saw, by the way, another headline that's going to get buried today. Nate Jones had season-ending surgery on his right elbow today. It was apparently a nerve readjustment or repositioning surgery. It wasn't on his ligaments or anything like that. It wasn't Tommy John. He's going to miss the rest of the year. It's a bummer because now he's had a couple pretty bad injuries now, but we won't get to see him pitch. But contractually, if I'm not mistaken, he had a clause that said that if he had elbow surgery before the end of 2018, his 2018 or 2019 team option was reduced to the league minimum, and similarly for the next one. So I don't know if this saves them some money. That's a bummer for Nate Jones if it does.
Yeah.
But that is news that is hitting today as well, and that's a drag.
Man, it's you know, yesterday sucked with no baseball and no baseball news. It was so quiet. Now today everything's happening, so at least something to distract us from the baseball-less, cold, dark reality of the post-All-Star break summer.
Yeah, seriously.
Go ahead.
I was going to move into the headline above Nate Jones on injury on Roto-World is Verlander is not drawing much trade interest, which, yeah, no kidding. but what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to kind of transition into, so the Quintana deal's done. You know, if I've said a couple times now that of the major, quote-unquote major trade pieces the White Sox had this season, he probably would have ranked fourth for me and most likely to be traded before July 31st. So it almost seems inevitable at this point that as soon as they get an offer that that they find to their liking for Robertson and then to a lesser extent for Frazier and Melky, that those guys are going to be gone. And if they can get another even, you know, somewhat high ceiling prospect for Robertson, I mean, there's more young talent coming. We listed off all the other guys, and there could be more.
Yeah, so the difference is, and this is something that Theo Epstein cited. Rick Morrissey wrote an article saying that it was because the Cubs are desperate. You know, I don't know that they're desperate. They are 43-45. They lost a couple games in the All-Star break. They're 5.5 back on the Brewers, and the Brewers look like, you know, the Brewers – it's not smoke and mirrors. They've got a plus 45 run differential. They got a lot of talent. They've got a lot of talent in the high minors that could come as reinforcements. I kind of thought the Brewers, like I said, would probably have been in the running for Quintana. You know, they have Lewis Brinson, and you know, they can afford to give up Lewis Brinson. They've got all kinds of super toolsed out athletic outfielders. Obviously Brinson's the best of them, but you know, the Cubs, geez, where was I going with that?
I don't know.
Here we go. In response to what you were saying, though, Robertson, the main, you know, trade partners for that would be teams that are Robertson's kind of a guy that like a team acquires mainly to help them once they think we're going to the postseason. This guy's going to help us in the postseason. I feel like, yes, at least that would fit the description of the Nationals, because the Nationals,
they don't need him to win the division.
No, they're yeah, right. Their bullpen's a disaster. They don't need him to win the division. Ditto the Dodgers. Ditto the Astros. You know, Red Sox to an extent, but like almost all of those teams, almost any team going to the playoffs would be happy to take like one more really good reliever, because we've seen it. We've all watched playoff games where it's like, oh man, like you get into a situation where it's like the fourth or fifth inning and it's a close game and your starter looks like trash, but you got to get through like four and a half more innings. And if you have like a Robertson to throw at it, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Like, oh shit, Trevor Bauer, you know, cut his finger on his drone. Yeah, exactly. Or something.
Exactly. So they don't need to rush that. I wouldn't be surprised if that didn't come until closer to the deadline for that reason. But at the same time, you know, because the advantage of trading for someone sooner, like in the Cubs position where they are in a dogfight for the division, I mean, they're tied with the Cardinals. I think the Cubs are probably, you know, if they played like 300 games out of those three teams, the Cubs should probably win the most out of them. But that's no guarantee for the next half a year. The Cubs are in a dogfight for that division. And trading for Quintana now means they get three more starts out of him than if they waited till the deadline, and that really matters. So I guess it's not, now that it's happened, it's easy to say, oh yeah, of course it would happen now. That, I mean, Theo cited that, Theo Epstein cited that as a reason to make the deal now. But they definitely, you know, the Cubs are in rough shape in many respects, and this trade meets a serious need for them both now and going forward, because, you know, for all that the Cubs have been an amazing organization, Hendricks is the only pitcher they've really developed in like forever, certainly for the rotation. John Lackey is obviously very old and very injured, and I think a free agent after this year. I think Jake Arrieta is a free agent after this year. And Arrieta was, you know, it's this old baseball wisdom or whatever. I think this comes from Bill James like 3-4 years ago, where the idea is like careers, Hall of Fame careers tend to start early and end late, for example. And, Arrieta was a late bloomer, and the fear with a late bloomer is like the reasons why it took him forever to be any good are the same reasons why he might not be very good for very long.
Yeah.
And I spoke to a friend of mine who does his own sort of like fiddling around with numbers for his own amusement with baseball, was saying that he felt that Arrieta was like just over a whole lot of lines in terms of things you can be good at. And when they were all combined, he looked amazing. And that if he deteriorated a little bit, it might fall off significantly. So, you know, Lester and to an extent Hendricks, depending on how much you believe in that profile moving forward, were the only guys they really had heading into next year, Montgomery. But, you know, this really solves their biggest problem in a lot of ways. You know, this is a really huge deal for the Cubs.
Yeah, and having him, you know, obviously they want him to help him. They want him to help them win the World Series this year, but they also want him to help them win the World Series next year and the year after that and the year after that. And that's the difference of – and that's one of the main reasons why Quintana costs so much, is because, you know, when teams acquire him, that's why the Braves were sniffing around on him. You know, the Braves aren't winning the World Series this year, but, you know, they've got this young farm of kids that are ready to come up, and they thought that he would help supplement their pitching staff. You know, it just doesn't seem – I feel like we were talking a few months ago about how rare it seems that, you know, a pitcher in their prime with multiple years of control left gets traded. And, you know, I don't think we could think of very many. Quintana, obviously, is one of them, and you see what the return is.
Yeah. You know, Eloy Jimenez is – you know, you can certainly read the transaction analysis up on BP.
Is it Eloy or is it Eloy? I think we should probably learn that at some point.
Oh, we should. I've always assumed it was Eloy.
I assumed it was Eloy.
I'm
really dumb.
It's probably better. I'm probably Americanizing the hell out of it. So, you know, who knows? Jimenez is like a classic power hitting corner outfielder profile. I think he's like 6'3". I think he's pretty short to the – I think what was the – short to the ball was the expression. He's got like described as 70, comfortably 70 raw power at present, according to Jeff Paternostro.
Yes.
He was the highest rated position player on our midseason 50 who doesn't play an up the middle defensive position. So that kind of speaks to him as just like a pure bat.
Yeah, that's why he was in discussion for the number one spot, I think, in the article that Jarrett posted of how they determined number one in the midseason top 50. You know, Aloy had that upside of certain things, but the thing that made him number eight as opposed to number seven, six, five, etc., was the fact that he doesn't play in up the middle position and everyone else in the top seven does.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, you look at the what I like about the midseason 50 is they have the why he will succeed and why he might fail, and the why he might fail for Aloy is he's the first prospect on our list who's likely to end up pretty far right on the defensive spectrum, so there better be a hell of a bat, which I guess means, you know, hey, if you have to shift him to first base, that puts a lot of pressure on him to hit, or even in a corner outfield spot for that matter.
Yeah,
but I think Keith Law mentioned that he likes his glove for a corner. He thinks he'll do well there. I mean, he's huge, and he's probably going to get bigger as he ages into his mid-20s.
But, yeah, I've read that he'll be fine in left field, and fine is fine if he can mash, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, he's still in A-ball. Is he in high A now? Is he in A-ball, yeah, something like that? So he's a ways away, so a lot can go wrong. But this is a profile that they didn't really have in the system. You know, just this middle of the order, I don't want to say no doubt, but just high probability, middle of the order bat.
It's rare that the White Sox have a hitting prospect who doesn't have a low floor. And Jimenez doesn't seem to have a very low floor. Like, even like Robber and Moncada, it's like, well, you know, Moncada's got four and a half tools, you know. But the tool that is the biggest question is the hit tool. And if the hit tool isn't there, then it kind of affects all the other ones, you know?
Yeah.
And Robber, it's like, they're, you know, we obviously haven't seen enough to judge, but, you know, there's a lot of people who like him and there's a lot of people who don't. So I feel like he's probably maybe the least volatile. That's probably the best way of putting it. He's the least volatile position player prospect they've probably had in a long time.
Right, because his reasonable floor would be something like what? He turns into like a league average first baseman.
Yeah.
As opposed to Moncada, who, you know, worst reasonable floor would be like, you know, gosh, I don't know.
I don't know either.
What was the example Jared gave was Dan Ugla?
You know, yeah, so Dan, like, Ugla, exactly.
But the thing is, you know, people have said that Moncada could be shifted to like center field and probably be good there.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like that helps his floor as well. I don't know. Eloy is – but you guys get the idea. Just like classic
He's Giancarlo Stanton. That's just what I'm going to keep saying. I'm going to keep saying it completely irresponsibly. He's just the next – he's the next Giancarlo Stanton, okay?
Sure.
Everyone shut up.
But, you know, classic corner outfielder who can mash and probably looks like he should be able to hit for contact as well. Which is exciting.
Yeah, he has 35 strikeouts in – well, this line doesn't have plate appearances. 35 strikeouts and 155 at-bats at High A, Myrtle Beach this year.
I just had it up. It's 35 out of 174 plate appearances.
Okay.
So that should be what, like 20%?
Yeah.
Something like that. So I don't know. That's pretty cool to me. He's obviously – like, he's definitely on the short list of guys who could be a centerpiece for a deal like this. You weren't getting Mejia from the Indians.
Devers.
Yeah, no, because like Devers may solve an immediate need even better than Quintana does for the Red Sox.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess like if the Rockies, you know, it's hard to predict what the Rockies would do, and the Rockies are in it, and they could probably use an arm. I mean, I guess maybe you could have gotten like Brendan Rodgers out of them, but like
that would have been cool.
Yeah, but like now you're already at the like that's where Eloy is. So
yeah, and you're picking nits if you're saying, "Oh, I'd rather have Brendan Rodgers than Eloy Jimenez." It's like, what the fuck do you know?
Yeah, I mean, maybe you say, "I want the shortstop." Yeah. Okay, but and Brinson was I think would have been probably been the asking price from the Brewers because he's right there as well. But I don't know. Exciting stuff. Like you said, Robertson should get something back. That's also really interesting. And I think you would point out Jeff Passan had posted an article today on the heels of this trade that said that the White Sox inarguably had the best farm system in baseball.
Yes, he did. Let me find the snippet. I want to quote him correctly. This is riveting radio, right?
Well, I mean, here. I can fill it because I mean, one of the things we'd be looking at would be obviously there's the high end. I think the MLB pipeline rankings because they have an active top 100. Ours only went to 50. The White Sox had 9, which was tied for the Braves for top 100 prospects currently. Yankees at 8. I think it's those. I think it would have to be those three organizations that you would be in that conversation.
Yeah.
I don't really know what the Brewers – I know the Brewers have a very nice system that's very deep. I'm not sure if it's quite – I don't know if it has the high end to compete. I mean, they've got 2 top 50 guys as opposed to the White Sox who have, what, like 6 now or something like that on our list.
If you include Jimenez and you include Robber, then it gets up to 6.
Yeah, and then, you know, the all the guys that we were talking about are kind of like right behind – in the next 20 to 30 guys after the 50 would be, you know, we know that we're pretty sure Dane Dunning would be there.
That's one of the guys, Jeff, which you can read this on Yahoo Sports, says that, you know, Dane Dunning, somewhere in the vicinity of their 12th best prospect, which personally I think is probably a little bit low even after this haul. But they say Dunning would be the number one prospect on a good 5 to 7 other teams, which I don't think is probably too unfair to say, and you know that just speaks to the depth they have. I remember we talked to Jeff Paternostro before the season, or it might have been right after the start of the season, and he talked about, you know, the White Sox, the organizational rankings, and what set the White Sox apart, or what kept them kind of at one tier below those top orgs, is that they were really top heavy. They didn't have a lot of depth. It's like you had the top like 8 or 9 or whatever after the offseason trades, and then it just totally dropped off from there.
Right.
You know, because then you're talking about Engel and you're talking about Trey Mikulczewski and stuff like that. And now I think they've kind of, you know, the more guys you add, the more it increases your depth and the more guys that you have the potential to plug holes with and to strike gold with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you know, some people thought Berger was a bit of a reach at 11. But usually, a top 20 draft pick is going to be kicking around at the tail end of a top 100, or at least in the conversation, depending on the pick and the year. But like, you know, the people who do like Berger and think he sticks at third base, I mean, I don't know, maybe you make a case for him. But like having your most recent first round pick probably not sniffing your top 10. I mean, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, but that's pretty nuts. You know, there's.
Especially like, when you're picking 11th overall or whatever the White Sox.
Right.
It'd be one thing if they were picking 26th and he didn't sniff their top 10, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, to basically have a top 10 pick and have him, you know, you have to argue to get him onto your top 10 is pretty nuts. And then having some guys in the teens, I mean, I'd have to think, I mean, do you feel, even the Adam Engel example, I feel better about him now than I did coming into the year just because he looked okay in the majors.
Yeah, I feel like he could reasonably be a fourth outfielder. I mean, his defense plays like crazy and he's fast as hell. So
yeah, and he held his own against major league pitching in a, you know, a small sample size, but like that's the biggest jump for any position for any prospect period. The good jump from the minors to the majors is bigger than any other jump. Maybe other than like amateur ball to pro ball, but no, it's got to be to the majors. And then you get, you know, and the prospect guys talk about this all the time. I mean, if you don't listen to BP Mets podcast, it incidentally is kind of our prospect podcast as well because of who's on it. And they talk all the time, and it makes sense about trying to project the hit tool is so freaking hard. And you have to give a lot of credit to a guy who's demonstrated an ability to make contact with major league pitching. Even as much as we can try to guess by looks at them and their stats in the minors, that's just so hard. So the fact that Engel has demonstrated that he could do it even a little bit is makes me feel that much better about him as a prospect. And that's we're talking about a dude who's like in the 15 to 20 range in the system, if that.
He is actually, I just went to Pipeline they actually already have the White Sox 30 updated with this trade, which surprised me. So they have Jimenez at number two behind Moncada, as we would expect.
I think that consensus, except maybe Law might still have – no, because he has Jimenez five. I mean, I know Law had Kopech really high.
Yeah. He has Dylan Cease eight, still behind Carson Falmer, which is interesting. I know Pipeline varies on Falmer from a couple other sources, but they go Moncada, Jimenez, Kopech, Robber, and Giolito is your top five. And then they go Lopez, Falmer, Cease, Collins, Birdie through 10. And then you were talking 15 to 20 range. So 11 through 20 is Basabe, Hanson, Dunning, Adams, Charlie Tilson still on here, Jordan Stevens, Alex Call, Jameson Fisher, Adam Engel, 19, and then Trey Mikalszewski, 20. We have Bernardo Flores, who I know a lot of people like, 21.
I like Bernardo Flores.
Micker Adolfo, who has taken a step forward this year at 23. Victor Diaz, 25, you know.
And Victor Diaz, like, is 25. He's a dude who would have been a top five prospect in the system like 5 years ago, because he's like got the Addison Reed argument. His dude's got a big fastball, and you know, looks like he could be a major league reliever. Ditto. I know James has spoken to people who look at Aaron Bummer, who's here at 28, who's, you know, he's a left-handed, almost certainly a reliever, but like he throws hard from the left side and looks like he might be a major league reliever. So, you know, this system is just, like, couldn't be farther away from where it was just a few years ago.
Yeah, Dane Dunning at 13, like, freaking blows my mind. I mean, he was a first-round pick 13 months ago.
And has performed really well in pro ball. So, yeah, I know – I think Callis is over with – Jim Callis is over with MLB Pipeline. He's always been bullish on Fulmer.
This doesn't have Berger anywhere. Do they not have guys from this year's draft? I guess
they
not.
Might. Well, isn't –
because Robert's on there.
They might not.
I mean, Berger definitely is in the top 30. So they must just not have updated with this year's draft.
Who'd the Marlins draft in the first round? He's got to be their number one, right?
All right, let's go that's over the way there. To check. Some more fun radio. Yeah, no, they have Braxton Garrett 1, Tyler Kolek 2.
I don't know.
Wait. Okay, the Rays, because everyone loved that.
McKay.
Yeah, McKay is not on here. All right, that's
okay. So
that's
they don't have decision topics. Yeah. There you go. So this does not. After all of it, you can hear us trying to reason this out.
We still have another guy to squeeze in here, and that's Berger. Who, again, well, I guess back to our larger point, Berger's definitely behind Dylan Cease, probably, right? So that means, at best, he's number 9, and I think people like Collins more than him too. So he's probably number 10, which is where Zach Birdie is. That's your first round pick a month ago.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think it's inarguable to use these. And obviously, like, you know, I don't know if Jeff wanted to use that headline or if it's just to make conversation, but the Braves system is pretty freaking nuts. It's really pitcher heavy near the top. And a lot of it's, I mean, Acuna's crazy good. Like Kevin Maitan is this sort of, he's almost this. It's like I want to say Paul Bunyan, but that's not the right example because he's so young and so far away. But people have been talking about him, like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he's the number one prospect in baseball within a year or two, sort of guy. Allard's had a really great year. I think Soroka's had a really great year.
Ian Anderson was a first round pick last year. Newcomb has actually looked pretty decent in some major league stints this year.
They added Luis Gohara in a trade. With Seattle, didn't they throw out? Isn't Alex Jackson still? Yeah, there he is. He's kicking around in this.
Yeah, they got him from Seattle. Him.
Joey Wentz. You know, it's arguable. I would say it's still arguable, but fair enough. It's cool that that's even a conversation for the White Sox at this stage.
Yeah,
it's really it was a big day. It was a big trade. I mean, I think this is definitely the biggest news since they signed Robert. I would think.
Yeah, and even probably bigger than that when it comes to, like, closer to instant impact stuff. Obviously, it impacts the current team in that Jose Quintana's no longer on it. You know, yeah. I know that there are people who it's kind of nutty, I agree with kind of both sides, where we're going to be doing some standing watching, you know, over the next couple months to see where the White Sox are going to pick in next year's draft as they kind of bottom out here. And it's something that I want to be far away from focusing on, because it just takes away the enjoyment of watching baseball, you know.
Yeah,
But the fact of the matter is that they're going to, barring something crazy, they're going to be adding a top five draft pick to their farm system again in less than a year. Right now, you know, season ended today. They're tied with Oakland for fourth worst record in baseball, or actually slightly behind Oakland. So technically, if the season ended today, they'd be picking fourth behind the three really, really bad NL teams, or really the two, the Phillies and the Giants. So it's going to be interesting to watch while also not focusing on, because I'm not going to watch the White Sox and root for them to lose. It's just not going to happen. You know?
I think the closest I ever came to that was in some of the really dark years when they kept trying the same plan, and they were acquiring all these players that I just never really liked and never thought would be any good. And I almost want them to just lose, because then it would show them that what they're doing isn't working. But I'm not there, because they're gonna finish with a top 10 pick for sure. I don't know that I'm like, oh, they're a slam dunk top five pick at this point, because weird stuff happens, and they still have players on this team that are weirdly good for a rebuilding team, and some young players who could improve, and some call ups who might be effective. So like I said, it might. But yeah, they're gonna get another piece of talent. And frankly, these last few drafts have kind of illustrated, I mean, jury's still out. A lot can happen between these players reaching the majors or not. But, like, you've had – I think it's pretty clear that 1-1 isn't necessarily every year this, like, guaranteed thing, right? I mean, there are years –
there's not going to be a Bryce Harper, Chris Bryant, Steven Strasburg type guy at the top of the draft every year.
That's kind of funny, too, because Bryant was not the number one pick.
Yeah,
but,
number two. Well, he was behind
Appel,
yeah. I brought up Bryant specifically because he was
He's that type of guy. Yeah, no, for sure. But, like, you know, you have – in the last couple drafts, you've had this mix of guys where it's this sort of trade between draft slotting and, you know, how much do you like this guy versus how much is he going to cost. And then you also have this mishmash of dudes where it's sort of like, well, there's this top 10 grouping and, you know – mileage may differ on how you feel about them, because, you know, Andrew Benintendi was, I think, 7 overall, for example, recently. And, you know, Buster Posey was 5, and that's going further back. But Conforto was 10. And guys who went ahead of them have obviously busted horribly. So, you know, they're going to have a top 10 pick. That's kind of trying to divine who will be available. Oh, they got the 5th pick instead of the 4th pick. Yeah, I mean, you can wind up with a situation where you kick yourself years later. I mean, sure, there was the draft. It was like Harper, who was 2, and then like Machado, and then Christian Colon was 4. And yeah, it's sucked for the Royals that they were 4 with like these 3 amazing dudes ahead of them. But like,
who did go number 2 that year? Was it Bundy?
No, because the Orioles didn't have 2 top picks in the top 5. I mean, I could just, I'll pull up Harper's page and click from there, but like, you drive yourself nuts. A top 10 pick is going to be really good. You could wind up with a better player at 7 or 8 than you would at 1. And it's so far out. Tyon was 2. Don't go crazy. Just,
no, I totally agree. I fell into that trap 2 years ago, where I was really, really focused on the White Sox record the last week or two. And it wasn't because of the draft pick as much as it was the free agent comp. This is the summer or the season before the big, you know, Hayward, Cespedes, Upton, and the White Sox didn't do jack shit year, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember caring a lot where the last day of the season the Mariners needed to win for the White Sox to get a top 10 protected pick. And I think Seth Smith hit like a come from behind walk off homer in the 9th inning that got the White Sox their protected pick. And I was so excited. I'm like, all right, they're going to be able to sign one of these big free agents and supplement the roster. And then I looked like an asshole and I was like, why the hell did I even care about this? So no, I'm done caring about it.
That was a very real thing where it was the difference between like a single game costs you protected free agency on your first pick or not.
Yeah.
And a year where you thought they were going to compete, and they really probably should have poofed that pick to sign a real free agent. So, no, that wasn't crazy. That wasn't crazy at all. But that was like But the idea of like, man, I hope they lose, like, I hope they finish with like 50 wins because then they'll draft like Seth Beer or something. Like, I don't.
Oh man, yeah. Well, we're at about 1:10 now, so maybe do you have anything else you want to add about this trade before we wrap up?
You know, I'm kind of relieved it's over, even though I'm sad Quintana's gone. I hope Quintana pitches amazing, and you know, if the Cubs win another World Series, I hope Quintana's still there, and I'd be happy for him.
Any thoughts on Outfield the Cat?
Outfield is adorable, and I'm really upset that we can't adopt him.
I threw that in specifically so that we will know if Mark listens to the entire podcast this week.
Oh, that's a good test. also, you could criticize Mark's looks. I think that would probably get our eyes out of it.
You know, Nick, you are more handsome than Mark.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I've been wearing the Yamiko Bears shirt that Mark got me quite a bit. And I've worn it like 3 times, and I think every single time I've worn it, somebody's asked me if I'm from Washington State. I'm like, no. It's just a cool shirt a friend got me. Mike Recchia has a pretty good comment on the White Sox forms. I don't know if you guys remember.
Mike Recchia, he's my former classmate at Eastern Illinois University.
Oh, okay. He was a White Sox minor leaguer. I think he retired a couple years ago.
He did.
He just said, I remember when I was prospect number 28 on Future Sox list, I'd probably be number 228 now. so, you know, self-deprecating players, former players is always good. Do you remember when I've referenced this before, when Jeff Blum referred to Winslow replacement, and he was like, yeah, I was the R. With the replacement.
That's good. Yeah, Recchia was on Eastern Illinois. It's probably their best baseball team in college history. I'm going into some Eastern Illinois baseball history on the podcast now, so you know we've really gotten off track. But they had like 5 guys get drafted that year, which is a big deal for a school as small as EIU. I think they had a junior lefty who went in the second round of the Angels that year who was probably the third or fourth best pitcher on the team, but he was the number one prospect because he was a lefty who threw like 98.
Yeah.
and he's out of baseball now. And I think all of them are out of baseball except Zach Bornstein, who was on the Israeli World Baseball Classic team and is in AAA with the Diamondbacks, I believe. But Recchia, I mentioned that like 5 or 6 guys got drafted that year because Recchia wasn't one of them. You know, he was he probably had the best numbers on that staff and didn't get drafted, wasn't a prospect, and hung around in organized ball for a little while. So shout out Mike Recchia. Listen to our podcast.
Yeah, for sure. I guess closing thoughts other than that is that it's just really – I guess it's really exciting to have such a stacked farm system, and hopefully we start seeing them called up. Hopefully we see it added to, even if, you know, Melky and Frazier – I mean, Frazier at this point – I wanted traded mostly just to clear up room on the infield,
right?
More than anything else, because like we talked about last week, it doesn't make any sense to call up. I mean, I guess you could just straight up bench Sanchez, but we talked about the potential repercussions for something like that because he's beloved in the clubhouse. He's done everything the organization's asked, and he's playing pretty well. So it would be probably a bad look in a rebuilding year to just turf him to the side for a AAA stud who hasn't, you know, mastered everything in AAA yet. And, you know, Frazier is another guy who's beloved in the clubhouse, and you certainly aren't just going to like bench him. So unless you want to like send Tim Anderson down, like,
yeah,
which is a discussion that makes me really sad. So yeah. I don't necessarily want to go into that. Do you think the White Sox trade Canely?
I do not. I do think that the volatility of relievers makes it so that if they got a you're distracting me with your tweets right now.
my nice tweets.
Yeah. I think the volatility of relievers make it so that if they got an offer that, you know, kind of was really difficult to refuse, where they got some really legitimate return, I wouldn't say no. But I also think that he's intriguing enough long-term option that you shouldn't trade him just because he's a reliever, you know. not like with Robertson, where it's like, well, we're going to get rid of his salary and, you know, open up spots for young guys. I think that Canely is – I like him. Yeah, if they got something, I wouldn't be really pissed if, like, someone offered them an actual legitimate, like, guy who will fit into the system and be highly ranked.
I mean, the closest comp I can think of to a Canely trade would be, what, Ken Giles?
Yeah.
Who was had probably been better than Canely for longer when he got dealt. And he brought back Vince Velasquez, Oberholzer, who I think was like maybe a fifth starter type guy, Eshelman, and Mark Appel, former 1-1. So, you know.
that's a bad trade for the Astros.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense for the organizational needs, but it felt like an overpay for a reliever, even though, like, Giles was coming off of, like, 100-something innings of an ERA under 2 or something like that.
And, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, Canely is the closest – that's the closest thing I could think of that comes to mind. So if you get somebody who wants to offer you that, maybe it makes sense to do it.
I mean, I think it would be cool if it was, like, a I could see it being, like, a – negotiations for like a Robertson, you know, with obviously everyone talks about the Nationals, they're the most obvious trade candidate for a reliever, but like, you know, I know you brought up that John Bernhardt, am I saying his name, that he piggybacked on your idea where it's like, why not package a couple of these relievers? You know, the Nationals adding a reliever will be very helpful to them, but adding two or three relievers would be very, very helpful to them, especially come October.
So right.
If you were able to package, like, I mean, why – it sounds crazy, but why is it crazy that you could just trade Robertson, Canely, and Swarzak for whatever?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that gets you up to Juan Soto, but, that'd be pretty cool. I don't – But given the Nationals' need and given the fact that you could stack three relievers, one of two of which would be there. You know, Robertson matches up with Harper's last year there, and Canely goes even further. I don't know. Those are three good to great relievers at just dumped. You know, basically erases your problem.
Yeah.
So that's got to be worth something. I don't know if the next guy down from Soto we talked to Craig last week, I think with Carter Kieboom would be the next guy down, who's like a plus bat, who's probably second or third baseman, not a shortstop. But, you know, that'd be another cool – I think Carter Kieboom's a top 100 guy too, or at least in the conversation. So, you know, there's stuff there. It's almost a shame that Jones and – I mean, it's a shame that Jones and Putnam are hurt too, because, hell, maybe you get – flip those guys also.
Seriously,
Okay, last question before we should probably wrap this up. Right after the trade, I was actually meeting up with Paul Boye for lunch. And when we met up, we were talking baseball, and he asked me, he was like, so do the White Sox trade Abreu now? And I had to think about that for like a while. I feel like, what are your thoughts?
I've thought about this for a while. I've written about it a few times where it's like, again, it's like, Jose Abreu's been more high profile than Quintana during his tenure, you know, especially after his rookie year when he was setting all those records and won rookie of the year at MVP consideration, et cetera. But like, I feel so attached to Jose Abreu, the player, that like more than Sale, more than Quintana, I'll be like devastated if they trade him just from a fan's perspective. You know, you talk about trying to separate the fandom from the analytical, unbiased analytical aspect. But at the same time, like, he's 30, you know, and he's an immobile slugging first baseman, and he's so much fun to watch. But like, if a team needs him and offers you something legitimate for him, how could you say no? You know, I brought up, I think during the off season, you know, the rumors were Colorado, and you know, Colorado's obviously in the playoff hunt. Ian Desmond has had injury problems and not being very good problems from time to time. I don't know who else would or could take him.
Right. I mean, first being limited to first base DH really does. We've seen that Edwin Encarnacion got a lot less money than we thought he would over the winter.
Yeah. I mean, the Yankees, Greg Bird, they hate and is hurt forever, you know. Yeah. And, you know, maybe the Rangers think they're still in the wild card race or something. You know, I feel like they might maybe, I guess the Gallo's emergence has kind of made it less necessary for them to acquire first base because he's been playing some first base since Beltre came off
like
the DL.
Maybe if like the Mariners were doing better, but again, they don't have much of a system. And the problem too is that I do think that there is a problem with going so scorched earth that you have like nothing at the major league level. I think that's demoralizing. I think this may sound touchy feely, but I think it is important, having been in a work environment as opposed to, you know, as a student, this sounded ridiculous to me, but having been in a work environment, I think it helps to feel, to have older peers to go to with questions and for advice. It makes a big difference. I think that for an organization that just brought in Moncada and Robert at a tremendous cost, I do think that it's meaningful. And not to say that it's like, oh, they're going to be friends because they're from the same country, because I don't know, think of all the people you dislike the most. They're probably from the same country as you. But like, but in the sense that adjusting from going from Cuba to being a very wealthy American is a significant change. And these, you know, Moncada and Robert are like 19, 22, something like that, 23. I mean, like, having someone who's older, who doesn't feel like your dad, you know, Brave's 30, he's not 50, you know, being able to just be like, hey, you know, it's, you know, this was a problem I had, or this is a place where you could go get food, like from home. Like, I don't know, like something to help with the adjustment and give you advice. I think there's something of value there. And like you said, giving the fans something to come watch, because you still want people to buy tickets and come to the freaking games and not like lose interest.
You think Jerry Reinsdorf still wants that to happen?
I mean, I think that Abreu, gosh, I'm probably this. You know what? James probably wrote about this once. This is probably why it feels smart. is that Abreu just might be more valuable just staying with the White Sox until the last year of his deal than he would be, you know, anything he could fetch in a trade.
Yeah, because Abreu fucking owns, and all the other things you said are true.
Fair
so
enough.
So I love Abreu, and if trading Abreu helps the future team get better, then I understand it. But just don't trade him. I don't want you to. All right.
Because he's something to watch every day.
Exactly. So we will call it there. I did want to make sure to plug before we signed off. To read, Ryan Schultz did our quick and dirty reaction to the Quintana trade today at bpsouthside.com. You can also read Nick's chat from Wednesday on the main site at Baseball Prospectus. Answered a lot of questions.
Timed that pretty poorly, huh?
Right? And then also, as I mentioned before, the top 50 busts list. And we will have more content related to Quintana in coming days, so be sure to be on the lookout for that.
Yeah, and I guess BP Wrigleyville would have more on Quintana now that he's a Cub.
Absolutely, yes, go there as well.
That's Cub.
Oh, also, shout out to WetButt23. I can't wait to find out when the Cubs find out who that is, and they get in trouble.
All set. Talk to you later, Kyle.
All right, bye.